Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers who bridge our two worlds. This podcast was brought to you by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. Today I'm joined by Balbina Huang, currently a visiting professor at Georgetown University and the National Defense University here in D.C. Ms. Huang is here to talk about the G20 summit meeting hosted in Seoul just last week on November 11th and 12th. More specifically, Ms. Huang offers her insights on what exactly was riding on the summit meeting, what actually happened there, and what the implications are for member nations now that the meeting has concluded. I'm here in the Korean Context studio with Ms. Balbina Huang. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure, it's a pleasure to be here.
Korea just became the first Asian and non-G7 country to serve as chair and to host a G20 leaders summit, which took place last week in Seoul. You recently wrote a paper for KEI's academic symposium, which was held at American University School of International Service last month. The draft paper was titled Bridging the Global Gap, Korea's Leadership Agenda for the G20. Could you tell us a little bit about what you discuss in that paper?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Essentially, the paper makes somewhat of an interesting argument, in that very often nobody really thinks of Korea as a leader, certainly not a global leader. Korea in recent years has become a leader in certain niches, certain high-tech industry, for example, certainly in the Korean wave, popular culture. But in terms of being a global leader, nobody, especially in Asia, would consider Korea a leader, partially because of the division of the Korean Peninsula, but also because of, frankly, relative size. Korea is, as has been traditionally, historically known, the shrimp among whales. So what this paper tries to do is point out that Korea is standing on a very interesting cusp of sort of leaving the past behind it and stepping into a new level of the future. And that is actually the coincidence of being the host to the G20. Now, it's not really a coincidence. I think President Lee Myung-bak actually pressed very hard to take the leadership. But the coincidence is of both the G20 having reached a very critical stage in its evolution, and also for Korea to really step out into the global spotlight and show itself as a global leader.
You wrote in that paper that the stakes could not be higher for Korea at the G20 summit, and quote the Financial Times as saying that just hosting the G20 is not going to be enough to elevate Korea's position in the world. Korea has to get consensus by the end of the talks, end quote. Could you elaborate on this and give us some insight on how the summit went and Korea's performance?
Well, first, I should say that now that the summit's over, I realize that, in fact, the stakes could not have been higher for another party other than Korea. And by that, I actually mean the United States. And in large part, it is partially of the United States' own making, in that it really, the United States really set itself up for a big disappointment at the G20 due to some high-profile unilateral actions it took in the week before the G20, namely the $600 billion stimulus package, and also the elevation of the currency issue. So, but putting that aside, in any case, for President Lee Myung-bak, who did take leadership of the G20, he really did gamble everything, his own political career, but also that of Korea, because first he's claiming that Korea was ready to host such a high-level global meeting. But also, he had set a very ambitious agenda. And also, the expectations were very high for the G20 going into the Seoul summit, primarily because the previous meeting of leaders in Toronto had been very disappointing. So the confluence of all those sorts of expectations, I think, set very, very high stakes indeed for this being the successful moment in which Korea could distinguish itself in Asia and in the world.
So you mentioned the Toronto summit being a disappointment, and you mentioned in your paper that it was disappointing because, you know, the member countries were drifting away from this crisis mode that had erupted, right, you know, in late 2008. What would you say the tone was of this summit?
Well, unfortunately, the tone was perhaps more antagonistic towards the United States than I think we, America, would have wanted. Having said that, I don't think it was nearly sort of the disaster that a lot of the headlines made it out to be. I mean, much of the commentary, if you read it, is sort of very cynical now about the G20. And there are many that are saying that it is what and has been essentially a failure in dealing with some of the world's most critical economic problems. I actually think that that might be an unfair assessment. I think that for the G20 itself, it actually did a lot better than people think or people are assessing at the moment. Having said that, it does show great limitations. The G20 were not able to resolve in any concrete way the currency issue that has become very divisive. Perhaps most important, what they did accomplish, though, was agreement on methods to help prevent another global crisis. And frankly, even though that's not nearly as exciting, and it's not quite a tangible result that most people like to see, in fact, that effect is actually very profound. And it's profound because given this, we are likely to be able to avoid another huge financial crisis at the level that we took in the fall of 2008. But again, what the G20 summit this time showed was that essentially U.S. leadership in the arena of the global economy is waning, and that's actually rather disturbing, I think, and that is not a very good outcome for the United States.
What is the long-term prognosis of the G20 as the world's leading body for international economic cooperation?
Now, as I said, I think I'm probably more optimistic than some of the initial analysis that's coming out now in the aftermath of the Seoul summit, both for the midterm and long-term of the G20. Of course, that actually means that quite a great deal of work needs to be done and the leaders need to dedicate themselves to making sure that the G20 stays viable. And a relevant organization for the future. But in fact, it certainly still has a way to go. And I think that is actually what the Seoul Summit showed. However, what's really interesting about the Seoul Summit that's different from the Toronto Summit is that in many ways, Toronto was sort of the very last summit of kind of the four or five summits that came to address the global crisis. And now we really have turned the page onto a new era for the future of the global economy and future of cooperation for the international economy. So this is really the beginning, and it will be critical to see what leaders can do about this in the future to address global issues.
You wrote about a three-pronged agenda that, if adopted, would demonstrate Korea effectively utilizing its unique place as a bridge between the more advanced G7 countries and the remaining developing economies of the G20. What were those three focal points, if you don't mind?
Going back just one moment to the very important role that Seoul has played, in part it's actually symbolic. Not only is Korea the first non-Western, non-G7 country to host, but if you look at the array of the G20 membership, South Korea actually literally is exactly in the middle of the two halves that separate the G20, meaning that you have 10 countries that are advanced, industrialized, essentially Western, with GDP per capitas of 40,000 and higher. And then you have the other nine countries below, with GDPs per capita that are below 20,000, that are all part of still part of the developing world. And South Korea is the only one that sits in the position right in the middle of a GDP per capita of close to 30,000. So, and given South Korea's very recent development experience, some in Korea would argue that they're still a developing country, but much of the experiences that the developing world is going through now is a distant memory for many of the advanced countries, but is a very recent memory for Koreans. And so it really does play a very important bridging role between those two halves of the G20, which is really very diverse. And many argue that that's one of the weaknesses of the G20, is that you do have a great diversity of memberships with very, very different goals and objectives and needs. And so Korea simply is the only one in the middle. Again, can play that role. Now, what the Korean leadership did preceding the Seoul summit was to emphasize three specific areas that could tangibly play that bridging role between the two halves. One was to focus on international trade as an engine of growth. And again, here, Korea's own development experience is a perfect example. Essentially, Korea's really rapid development hinged on this export-led growth. On the other hand, we can also learn lessons from Korea's experience in that while Korea itself pursued export-led growth, it was essentially protectionist in its own markets. And the Korean leadership recognizes that and essentially admits that. And so Korea is very strongly pushing, instead of that particular model, certainly aggressive exports, but also to open domestic markets for developing countries. And so, again, that is the bridging role. Now, as we all know, promotion of free trade is certainly at the top of agendas of many, many countries around the world today because of the economic downturn. And so, again, it shows that this is a key priority for the entire world economy. Now, the second agenda item was focused on development. And this is an area that has been suffering in recent years, primarily because we've seen some problems with the World Bank, certainly with the IMF, and frankly, also the United Nations and its ability to really lead global development efforts. And so this is actually a unique way for a small country like Korea to sort of show itself as a real-life example, but then argue for new and innovative ways of development. Clearly, many development strategies have not worked. Much of it is dumping development aid. And so Korea can come up with some very interesting and innovative suggestions, focusing on, for example, infrastructure, long-term growth. And that also ties into the theme of the stated goal of the G20 itself, which is to promote a sustainable growth well into the future. And so I think that Korea has done a very good job doing that by tying development projects into the goal itself of the G20 and as part of the world economy. And finally, the third agenda item is the focus on climate change or green growth. Now, green growth is Korea's own particular strategy of how to address climate change within its own domestic economy. And it's actually quite an interesting strategy because it sets up national goals on how to not only try to meet international objectives of addressing climate change, but also certainly within Korea itself of improving environmental standards, but then also ties it in very much into economic growth over the long term. So again, it's a very interesting way to tie together all of the themes that bring the clear agenda items of the G20 into clear focus.
Now, you wrote this paper and you put forth these ideas, obviously, prior to the actual G20 summit. But now that it's taken place, I'd love to ask you, how closely did Seoul adhere to these ideas?
Well, unfortunately, I would love to say that, you know, Seoul scored an A-plus on every single one of these recommendations. I don't think it was for lack of trying. I think that Korea did really try to stick to these three goals, and I think these goals were priority goals. Unfortunately, of course, events overtook the summit itself. And one of these, of course, was the currency issue, which, of course, has been simmering for quite a while. This is certainly not a new issue. But it really sort of practically exploded just in the last several weeks. And so that, unfortunately, really became the single biggest issue. And it is unfortunate because in some ways, while I'm not trying to sort of dismiss this as an important issue, it certainly is, it is too bad that it took over in many ways the talk of the summit. Now, what Korea did very well was they tried to really push for some agreement in the working group sessions prior to the leaders' meeting. And so, in fact, the currency didn't necessarily dominate each meeting. But the differences, underlying differences of the major countries, and that is primarily China and the U.S., were certainly the driving dynamic. So that was rather unfortunate. And then, of course, the single biggest disappointment was the lack of agreement on the CORUS FTA. In fact,
which actually wasn't part of the G20 agenda itself.
That's right. It really wasn't, and yet that is. But in some ways, what Korea did. Korea actually steered the focus of the Seoul summit in many ways onto this bilateral agreement. Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose you might then criticize Korea for having done that because then it really set up expectations. On the other hand, it was really the CORUS FTA, if it had been successfully agreed to by the summit itself, that Korea could have touted as sort of the shining example of this global free trade agenda. And that was really the key, because the CORUS FTA would, in fact, tie together all these other three, topics. So, for example, sustainable growth for development, and also even green growth, because what this does is open up tremendous markets for all sorts of green technologies. So it really is a very, very big disappointment, and I think this, unfortunately, will have repercussions, frankly, far more for the United States than for Korea. The reality is that Korea can still turn around and say, we are still one of the few leaders, certainly in East Asia, for free trade agreements. Korea is the most aggressive of East Asia of seeking free trade agreements. They're the ones, Korea is the one that's gone the farthest. They've already negotiated a very important and very big free trade agreement with the EU. And frankly speaking, that actually should shame the United States. And Korea is on the cusp of aggressively pushing for FTAs with Australia. And now, of course, there is talk of trying to get something going with China, Japan, and so on. So I think this, unfortunately, is a much bigger loss for the United States.
Clearly, there's a spotlight shown on China here. I mean, it's playing a large role in the G20. But you mentioned in your paper that it has not ever played a leadership role in the G20. How does that come to be?
Well, a number of factors. First is, I think, again, what was so interesting about this G20 is, as I said, the Seoul summit is really the first one in the G20's history that marks the major shift from a Western, industrialized, dominated type of international grouping, economic grouping. So Seoul is sort of the first step towards a real shift in the balance of weight, if you will, towards the recognition that India, Brazil, China, those countries also carry a lot of weight. Now, having said that, I frankly am not one of these people that thinks that China is ready to compete with the United States. I think certainly China puts competitive pressures on the United States. But in terms of being a real rival, I think China has a long way to go. And in fact, I think China has a long way to go to even catch up to Japan, frankly, even though the reports are that the Chinese economy technically is larger than the Japanese overall. The fact is, so in many ways, I think that we are overestimating China's strength. Now, that does not mean that China is unimportant. Certainly, China's rapid growth in the last several years has had a tremendous impact on global politics and the global economy. The real question is, what is China going to do with its rise in economic power? It is certainly using its strength, its economic strength, to as a tool to further its own national goals. Now, all around the world, For example, investing huge sums of money in many, many developing areas in order to secure, for example, energy needs or other types of resource needs. Now, there's actually nothing wrong with a country using its economic resources to pursue its national goals. In fact, it would probably be irresponsible for any country to not do that. But there are, in fact, questionable repercussions for the rest of the world. Because, first of all, again, the sort of rapidity with which China's economic strength is growing, but also, frankly, the scale of it is quite large. And I don't think the United States or the Western world has really seen this kind of economic power sort of rising up to possibly challenge American goals. We haven't seen this essentially since the 1980s when it was Japan, but I would argue that I think this is actually of a different nature. And Japan is certainly quite a different power because Japan, for a whole variety of specific reasons, certainly, but is not really and can never really be a global power, partially due to some very specific restrictions that it has in its constitution and so on. So the real question is, what will China do? And how much of a leader can China really be? And thus far, I don't think China has shown any real global leadership, frankly speaking, and moreover, has not really shown any indication that it is either interested in being a responsible leader anytime in the near future, certainly, or that it has any idea how to do that. So it's a real question mark for the world.
Now, I'd like to shift back and take another look at the U.S. As you mentioned earlier, the United States had a lot riding on this G20 summit when going into it and actually may have been hurt by the outcome. Would you say that we're seeing a longer-term shift in the U.S.'s power on the world stage, or is this just, you know, more of a short-term effect of perhaps the president losing the midterm elections and some of the political atmosphere here in the U.S.?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, the U.S. Performance and, frankly, President Obama's trip to Asia was quite disappointing. Now, I think it has a little bit more, or frankly, quite a bit more to do than just with the midterm elections itself, although, frankly, that's what President Obama himself is claiming, that it was really sort of a result of this. I actually don't think so. Having said that, I am of one of the people, firm belief in sort of that American primacy will actually continue. And again, despite China's meteoric rise, I really don't think China can really challenge the United States in that regard. And so I'm quite convinced that the United States will bounce back. Now, the problem is that we're not bouncing back quickly enough, frankly, and it's not going to be any time in the short term. And so my real concern is right now, the immediate term, as well as the short term. And I think that it's not going in a very good direction. And so it's really rather unfortunate.
Now that the G20 summit is concluded, what are some of the next steps for Seoul, and also what position does Seoul find itself in now on the world stage?
Well, again, and this is where I would argue that the G20 was a success, and quite a big one for Seoul. I think it leaves Seoul in a very, very good place. In fact, some of the successes of Seoul is due to things that didn't occur. For example, going into the summit, one of my most worrisome concerns was actually the possibility of just very, very bad riots in Korea itself, protesting not just the G20, but the CORUS FTA, or even other security issues. For example, many people worried about some sort of North Korean provocation. In fact, nothing of that sort happened. And I think that was not an accident. I think it really goes to show the incredible resources, planning, organization, and execution the Koreans put into it. And so that, you know, that was not by accident, and the Koreans deserve a lot of credit. What that means also is that Korea can consider itself a world-class country that can pull these kinds of things off. That is not a small thing. Now, I think Seoul also shows, again, that small countries can actually have a voice. And although it was not, you know, 100% successful in really pushing through the focus of the G20, what it did was it did keep the members together, and they actually did come out with some pretty strong statements. Certainly more work to be done in the future, but again, this shows that the shift in the G20 that's occurred. I think the real disappointment is for the United States, and we really took a beating. We took a beating in a number of areas, but I think the White House now has some very, very serious thinking to do about what its priorities are and how it's going to fit all of these pieces together. If if Obama got a beating at home because the public felt that he was not paying enough attention to the economy, the problem is that during the G20 and the trip to Asia, it came across that Obama was really only concerned about very narrow U.S. goals. That's sort of the impression that he gave. And so there are real questions about how much the United States can really be an effective leader in Asia. You asked me earlier whether China was ready to be a leader, and I said no. But what's rather depressing is that I think the United States is backing off from any positive leadership role. And so Washington's going to have a very big task ahead of it, trying to figure out how it's going to move forward. Of course, FTA cannot be resolved, then this is a major problem for the U.S. role in Asia and for global free trade. So there's a lot riding on how the U.S. essentially pulls itself up from this not very positive showing.
Now, from the perspective of the G20, what needs to happen next?
Now, it is interesting because the next presidency will revert to France. And so now we see the shift back towards a sort of, you know, European type of leadership. But in some ways, that might not be such a bad step, because what was evident here in these discussions is that there's still a lot of disagreement. Some of it, I don't want to say petty, because that sort of diminishes the importance of the actual disagreements. But it did come down to sort of very specific kind of national goals. And actually, the Europeans have a lot more experience overcoming these in many ways through the EU. And so it might actually work out. I think that now what needs to be done is the countries need to sort of live up to what they agreed to on paper. And again, that's why the G20 was not the failure that everybody says it was, because they all walked away essentially agreeing to principles. That's the most important thing. Now the real work is trying to put specific words and actions into those principles. And hopefully that will happen throughout the next series of summits.
Belvina, thank you so much for this conversation today. It was very insightful, and we look forward to seeing you again, hopefully.
Thank you very much.
For more information about this episode, this podcast, and upcoming KEI events, please check out our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. As always, please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggested podcast topics to me at podcast@keia.org. I'd love to hear from you, so please don't be shy. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. It was a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Korean Context. Bye.